with Anne Cripps, recorded for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Collection. I'll be speaking with Anne about her work in Tasmania as a landscape and garden history consultant, and also about the first 20 years of the Australian Garden History Society, as Anne was a foundation member when the society formed in 1980. The interview is taking place at Battery Point, Tasmania, on Friday, the 25th of August, 2023. The interviewer is Jean Elder, and our recorder is Rhonda Hamilton. The Australian Garden History Society acknowledges traditional owners of country throughout Australia. We pay respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and to elders past, present, and emerging. So, Anne, welcome. And can you tell us a little about your early years, where you were born and where you grew up?
I was born in Hobart. I lived some of my early life in Sydney and then came back to Hobart, went to school, collegiate school, and I lived with my grandparents up at Ferntree. And I think that's where my love of gardening first began.
Mm. How old were you then?
I visited my grandparents many times as a very young child, but then when I came back, I would have been about 10. It was only recently that I found out a little bit more about the association of the wonderful garden at Ferntree, which is Litchin Gate, Pillinger Drive. It was very much a Gertrude Jekyll type garden, and wonderful sort of walks and hidden places, a wonderful garden for a child to enjoy. And my favourite occupation was to go out in the garden with my grandmother. I found out later when I was doing some work for Marcree, which is the house in Hobart that was given to TMAG and became a house museum in 2011. And that had formerly belonged to the Baldwin family. The house was an arts and crafts house built by Bernard Walker. And the garden was designed by Cecil Baldwin. He went to Burnley, and he and Eileen Bamford and Gertrude Jekyll were all there at around the same time. And my grandmother's next door neighbour, who she was always gardening with and visiting gardens, and was Eileen Bamford or Eileen Wood. When Eileen and Edna Walling left Burnley, they decided that they would set up a landscaping business together. This is according to family records. But this didn't eventuate because Eileen married and moved to Hobart and lived at Ferntree. So I think that was fascinating to find out that association, because the garden at Ferntree, my grandmother's garden, was very much, influenced by that period.
By that whole era.
That whole era.
Did you have your own little garden there, as so often happened with children?
Oh, I had my own wheelbarrow and I had my own watering can, and I just followed my grandmother around. And I used to love the rockery and the laburnum walk and all of those sorts of things. I just loved it.
Mm-hmm. And this interest, after you finished school, where did that lead you, or where did your schooling take you?
My schooling took me to after school to the State Library, where I there was a group of us then. To become a librarian, it wasn't a university course at that stage. It was an in-service course at the State Library. And you moved around into different sections of the library, so lending library, children's library, reference library, periodicals, and bookmobile. So I think I learnt from the training that we were given, I learnt about research, and I'd always had an interest in history, I'd always had an interest in gardening, And I think those things just sort of came together.
Mm-hmm. Very much so, I can see. It also would have given you a great understanding of, as you say, research and archives and how to go about it. When was the first steps towards taking on work, public commissions in that area of history research, history research?
I married an architect, my husband Peter, who was very involved in restoration work, and for many years was down at Port Arthur working there. He had his he was involved in a private practice that was commissioned to do work at Port Arthur. They were the first group of architects and engineers who did work on that site and tried to restore and understand the site. And we would talk about this work, and I said, you know, what about the gardens? What about the plants? And so Peter and I, through sort of just general discussion, we realised that you can't just look at a building. You've got to look at the environment around the building. And so that became an interest for both of us, that, yes, the building was important, but the landscape around the building was equally important.
So in that period when you really were the first sort of major public commission, the first one was the Bishop's Court, am I right? But earlier than that, you had done some smaller private commissions.
I'd done some, I suppose, some help with friends who had old properties, and I suppose tried to engage with them and make them aware that the garden was just as important as the house. And then when there was talk of the establishment of the Australian Garden History Society, a letter went out to all of the architects that were involved in restoration work. And Peter got the letter, and I can distinctly remember him saying to me, "I'm too busy. You go." And so that's how I became involved in the Garden History Society, and also then involved in some commissions to do work.
So the commissions came around about that time. Tell us a little more about the Bishop's Court project.
Well, Bishop's Court, again, Peter was doing a conservation management plan for the house, and we felt that it was very important that the grounds should also be included. And so I did the work on the grounds, and then that was became a conservation management plan of the whole site. There were some very interesting things there. There was a great dip in the lawn, and it's the current bishop had said, "Oh, you know, that is so annoying, we need to fill that in." And I was puzzled over it. And then I found out that it was actually, found some very early photographs, and it was an amphitheatre. And each year, the children of the various homes and the Sunday schools would come and perform plays for their parents and other people involved in the Anglican Church. So, you know, that was just one of those things. No, you don't fill that in, because that is important. Roses that had been planted by one of the bishop's wives when she established a garden around the tennis court. There were a lot of interesting connections, plus the fact that the site, one of the bishops there was Bishop Montgomery, whose son, of course, was Field Marshal Montgomery. And so planting of trees and the history of the site was very, very important. And from that work, we realised that we needed some money and some help. And so we put in a submission to the Australian Garden History Society, the Tasmanian branch, and they were very generous in helping us over a couple of years with things like, you know, tree work and sort of major expenses that were required.
Mm-hmm. What year was that? That was roughly...
That was in 1980...
Quite early on.
Yeah, it's all right.
I've forgotten as well. Oh, yeah. And then from there, don't worry, we can add the date later. The Marquis House, Marquis was probably...
Well, I think probably the one, the other commission that was interesting from around that period was a commission from the National Parks to look at exotics in the East and West Pillinger and along the Lyell Highway. And they were very much, the feeling of at the time was that anything that wasn't an endemic Tasmanian plant was a weed and therefore should be removed. So we had a wonderful, very interesting trip round the West Coast looking at plants that had been established, European plants that had been established in the early miners' gardens and other areas such as along the railway line. We had plans of the site, we had plans of the railway station along at West Pillinger, and the railway station had gone, but there was this row of irises. We measured the row of irises, related that measurement back to the measurement of the railway station, exactly the same. So there were all those interesting things. But it was very difficult to convince the parks people that there was historic importance in the European plants that were around there. And I felt that, yes, ivy can become invasive, but a lot of them really didn't have the potential to become invasive and were important remnants of the early settlement around there.
Did you have success in that negotiation?
I am not sure. I'm not sure whether they actually kept things or whether they just decided, no, that's too hard, we'll mm-hmm. just keep it as it is yeah. and keep an eye on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The other, I guess one of the interesting whether your research interests sort of changed over time from those first early years, or it still remained very much looking at landscapes and the importance of plants and gardens and the old historic homes?
I think in the early times of my research, I concentrated more on the history of the site and the building, the families that had sort of lived there over the time. And it led me on to an interest in who supplied the plants, the gardeners, the establishment of nurseries here, the supply of plants, the exchange of plants, and I became a lot more interested in that side of garden history.
Mm-hmm. And clearly, in your book of gardeners, plant collectors, friends, Hobart Town and Beyond, a lot of this research comes together, the research
yes.
over the years in terms
yes.
of about nurserymen and early gardeners. What I know, the book covers such a wide area, it's hard to ask a question, but I'm wondering, were there key things that stood out for you in terms when you're writing the book about the early nurserymen and gardeners?
Well, I suppose because of my involvement in Narina and Narina in Battery Point, being a part of Robert Knopwood's land grant where he established his garden, Cottage Green, I suppose he was one of the first people that I became interested in. Looking at his diary, or which he kept daily, and in that he wrote about what was going on in the colony. But for me, the important thing was that he wrote about the establishment of his garden. And so I suppose he was the catalyst, and then I went on to research some of the people that Knopwood had mentioned in his diary, and look at the early nurserymen who established gardens and who supplied plants, and also looking at the plant collectors that came here. And
you talk about in the book the importance of the Quaker influence in this early horticultural endeavours.
Yes, I find the Quakers absolutely fascinating. The fact that the Quakers couldn't go to the universities in England, and so they studied plants, and they became very involved in horticulture and plant collecting. And a lot of the well-off Quakers then encouraged the other Quakers, such as Fothergill sponsored James Parkinson to come out on Cook's expedition as the botanical artist. And Fothergill also established a school, Aquas School up in York, Yorkshire, where a lot of the early nurserymen and colonists who were not the wealthy went there, as they were sponsored or their education was paid for. And there they learnt about gardening, about there was a very large kitchen garden, there were orchards. They learnt all of those skills, which then I think equipped them to come out here and establish gardens and set up as nurserymen.
The Chandler Nursery, William Chandler, he was an important early nurseryman, but not part of the Quaker connection.
Not part of the Quakers. The first William Chandler came out as an assigned under the assignment scheme, and so he came out and was assigned to John Leake up in the north of the state. And from there, he then, after he married, he came down. He was married at St. George's Church in Battery Point, and he came down here and went to Government House as the gardener there, head gardener. And then his son gained an apprenticeship at the what were the Royal Society Gardens. And from there, he then established Chandler's Nursery.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, fascinating links with the northern connection, then the gardens at Government House, the Royal Society Gardens, and then a nursery that is still today in family hands.
Still going strong. You also write in your introduction in the book that the gardening and art have always been intertwined. I'm just interested in your thoughts about that, gardening and art. And partly you also describe the four quite important women of that era, the early colonial era, and at least two of them, Mary Morton and Louise...
Mary Morton Allport and
Louise. Allport and Louise.
And Meredith, yes.
Were artists as well as gardeners.
Yes. Well, I mean, there were botanical artists, and then there were just artists who loved plants. There were the women, and then also there was Frederick Mackey, who a Quaker. But I was just amazed at what I found about Frederick Mackey. He came out here on a mission journey to check on the conditions of the convicts, the Aborigines, and the settlers, the Quaker settlers. He, with Robert Lindsay, travelled for some years around Australasia, and he kept a journal, and in that journal he sketched the plants that he saw. He married at the end of the mission journey and came back here and established a small Quaker school, because there was no Quaker school in the colony. And the Quaker Friends Meeting House in Murray Street, they let him a couple of rooms for this school, which had previously been a nursery run by James Dickinson, who came out here as a convict. So Mackey, when he left and went to South Australia to be with his wife's father, I thought, what happened to him? He was somebody who had come from a family of nurserymen in England, who had worked as a schoolmaster here, but who in his journal had written about all the plants that he had seen. He'd sketched them, and what happened to him. And I was talking to a friend about this, and she said, I wonder if my Quaker old school friend knows anything about Frederick Mackey. It turned out that they were descendants, and they sent to me his sketchbook, or his book that he had kept when he went to South Australia. And from that I was able to find that he was into plant breeding as well as growing plants for nurserymen in South Australia. So, a link between gardening and art, which of course, as you mentioned, was very much to the fore with people like Louisa Ann Meredith and Mary Morton Allport. The Allports are interesting. Joseph Allport was a solicitor, but he was a very keen gardener, and he was established a very successful garden at Aldridge Lodge. He exhibited plants at the horticultural shows, exhibitions, and his wife drew and painted painted miniatures on ivory of some of the plants that Joseph collected from the environment of Kunani, Mount Wellington.
Mm-hmm. And they're exquisite, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely exquisite.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it, from that early first colonial days, we still have iris shows and the best rhododendron shows, mm. and mm. It's still, the garden are still fascinating. There's still that interest in
oh, yes, yes. In fact, I gave a talk at the Horticultural Society of Hobart Horticultural Society about a week ago, talking about those early years of the society, and the thing that the members were amazed at was the variety of plants that were exhibited, including the pineapple. I mean, who would have thought that they would be growing the pineapple in Hobart Town?
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And they were, and exhibiting.
Yes. I guess one more question relating before we move on to talk about Garden History Society. History. What do you think? What were the learnings from those early gardeners and horticulturists that have relevance for today's gardening and horticulture? I'm just thinking of their seed propagation, their spreading of exchanging of seeds and ideas. Their lessons too for our.
Well, I think there was one very amusing report in the paper after one of the early exhibitions. And one of the comments that was made was that the it was a great shame that the wealthier garden owners, when they were gardening, were just throwing out plants and seeds that could have been given to others for establishing their gardens. The other interesting thing is that they were, from very early times, they were even in Knopwood's garden, they were growing exotics and endemics in their garden. They were very much into kitchen garden, of course, because that was a source of food when there was an unreliable source from the government gardens and from the unreliability of the shipping. So, I mean, again, I think that they were, I mean, things today that are still relevant is to keep up with your propagation and sharing of plants and seeds, the importance of the kitchen garden, the importance of growing exotics and endemics. Yes, I think that a lot of what they were doing is still very relevant today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And some of the, you mentioned in your book too, some of the early conservation ideas. Well, there were, I think that was from Louisa Ann Meredith.
I think she could probably be one of the first conservationists.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fashion to, when you had a ball or a party, to go up to the mountain and cut fronds from the ferns and other plants and, you know, decorate the ballroom. She wrote very decisively about the policy of going in and clearing land, that should not be done, and that you should be keeping some of the trees and some of the natural landscape. So I think she made people aware of that they were doing the wrong thing if they just came in and cleared the land, and also if they went into areas such as the Kunani Mount Wellington and just randomly cut trees and plants from there.
We certainly could do with her voice today, couldn't we?
Yes, yes.
Now we come to talk about the early history of the Australian Garden History Society. And Anne, you've had a long involvement with AGHS as a foundation member of the national organisation founded in 1980. You were also one of four people on the Tasmanian Committee of AGHS established in 1981. And I think it was established largely to organise in 1982. The National Conference mm-hmm. in Hobart. You then spent 4 years as a committee member at that stage. Then in 1990, you began serving a total of 9 years as secretary of the Tasmanian Committee, including 6 years as the Tasmanian rep on the National Management Committee. You've made an enormous contribution to AGHS, both at a state and national level. But back to the early days, I think to start getting some of the history in perspective, can you tell us we touched on it earlier in the interview, how the AGHS came to be established in 1980?
Well, I think the first impetus was when the Australian Heritage Commission funded a survey of historic gardens in all of the states. And from that, there was the exhibition, which was curated by Howard Tanner and Peter Watts, called Converting the Wilderness, the Art of Gardening in Colonial Australia. And that was a travelling exhibition which began in 1979 and went through to 1980. Then there was a proposal to establish an Australian Garden History Society. There was a very well-established Garden History Society in England, And the idea that was that this the Australian one would be very much based on the English one. And so a letter was sent out to various people and organisations, inviting them to a meeting in Melbourne to discuss this proposal. And I went to that meeting, and from there the Australian Garden History Society was established. And we had a decided to establish a branch here, as you mentioned, and then we were involved in the establishment or the running of one of the early conferences.
Mm-hmm. I'll come to the conferences a bit later, but I'm interested just exploring a bit first about the kind of activities of the AGHS TAS. In 1981, the first Tasmanian excursion was held at Ferntree in December of that year. It was a picnic lunch provided, and after an 8-minute leisurely walk through the Ferntree Glade past some interesting gardens, that was the description in the newsletter. So began Tasmanian garden visits and excursions. And I'm just interested, can you tell us more about these early visits and lectures? There seemed to be regular visits, and very early on became a practice of having lectures of key
yes.
people.
Because this was such a new organisation, we felt very much that we had to tell everybody what our aims were. And this was, of course, to promote an interest in historic gardens and the plants that were growing in these gardens. And we were not an association that had just been established so that people could go and visit lovely gardens. So therefore the lecture side of it became very important. And if we went to a garden, the owner was invited to talk about the garden and the establishment of the garden. And quite often one of our members would have done some research into that garden. So the educational role of the association was very important to us. So we very early on we had Gay Clock talking about Kitty Henry, and then we had.
Can you just interrupt you? Can you tell us a little about? For those listening, Kitty Henry?
Kitty Henry was a florist, but she had been very much part of the sort of, I suppose, the 1930s, 1940s sort of garden scene in Hobart. And Gay Clock, who owned an old property down in Sandy Bay, she had worked with Gay Clock. And so that was one of the reasons for going down there and looking at Gay's garden, and also for Gay to give us a lecture on Kitty Henry. At the same time, because we were in the area of the Lipscomb family nurseries, I gave a talk on family nurseries such as the Chandlers and the Lipscombs.
So it started, interest in family nursery started very early.
Started very early, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And also, I suppose about 10 years later, our interest in dry climate gardens and the problems of gardening in dry areas such as the East Coast was something that we felt we should also look at. And so we had a weekend on the East Coast with lectures on historic gardens, how do you cope with gardening in a dry climate. Mm-hmm. So again, the mix of garden visiting and lectures.
Mm-hmm. And I'm reading the early newsletters in August 1983, Mr. Frank Walker writes of the importance of collation of information about old landscape ruins, isolated exotic trees across Tasmanian roads. And he called upon AGHS TAS members to contribute to this project. Perhaps this is one of the first advocacy projects that the society took on?
Yes, the Walker family, again, family of nurserymen. So his father, Frank Walker, established a nursery in Launceston in the 1870s, and his son, Frank, was the chief horticulturalist with the Tasmanian Department of Agriculture, and he was actually awarded a Vetch Memorial Gold Medal from the Royal Horticultural Society in England for his work on urban horticulture. So he was very much a man before his time. Mm-hmm. So he was very concerned about the desecration of some of the old trees. And again, the history, such as the Memorial Avenue of Trees from Hobart to Launceston. So he wrote some articles for our journal, or it was a newsletter. And I think probably that was the impetus for the Register of Trees.
Ah.
So a very interesting man, and he was certainly a valuable source of inspiration for the Garden History Society and the roles that we wanted to get involved in, such as mm-hmm. advocacy.
So possibly then that was the beginning of the National Trust Significant Tree Register.
Yes.
Right, I'd wondered what happened to his collation. So there, that's where it went. Mm. And then in September 1985, in one of the newsletters, there's another mention of an advocacy project with a campaign by Mark Herberg, to save a sequoia in Newtown. And this was successful. He actually petitioned Hobart City Council.
Yes, Mark Herberg was on our first committee. He was education officer at the Royal Tasmanian Botanic Gardens, and he wrote a history of the botanical gardens. A wonderful man, and he, in a very quiet way, just gave us so much help and direction in those early years. Yes, his campaign was successful, and it was another advocacy project that the association was involved in. Another one in the north of the state was the Killane, which in 1965, the property at Westbury, which had been bought by Dr. and Mrs. Laker. He was a vet and very passionate gardener and landscaper, and he was absolutely horrified when the Department of Main Roads decided that they needed to widen the road and that would go through part of his property. So he asked the Australian Garden History Society Tasmanian branch whether we would help with that, and we did, and again that project was successful. The road wasn't widened and his property wasn't impacted.
And then another early stages of conservation. In 1983, this was the national body published guidelines for the preparation of conservation plans. And
yes.
I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit about this publication and how it was used, and did it go on to that important Port Arthur weekend in April 1984?
Yes, there were a number of publications which were produced around about that same time. 1983, the Australian Garden History Society published their guidelines, very valuable booklet, looking at various aspects that you needed, such as research, looking at geology and soils, historical research, climatic data, all of those sorts of things that probably we now take for granted. But at that stage, that we needed guidelines. At the same time, the Heritage Commission published a document on how to record the national estate values of gardens, and the National Trust published a bulletin on planting circa 1950 to 1900, which listed all the plants and trees and other interesting information that was needed if you were looking at your garden or a conservation management plan of the garden. So all of those things were new tools, but they all added to what we needed to try and encourage people to look at the historic importance of gardens and landscapes.
Mm-hmm. And the conference that you organised in at Port Arthur, that was a joint one, wasn't it?
That was a weekend that was organised with the Port Arthur Historic Management Authority. And we had about 50 delegates at that meeting from all over Australia. So it wasn't just a Tasmanian branch activity. And we had some very interesting lecturers looking at researching historic gardens, establishing the criteria for the restoration of a colonial garden, the use of landscape and in conservation, and the plants that we looked at the plants that were growing at Port Arthur and the history behind those plants and sort of how they came into Van Diemen's Land. And then we had somebody who looked at the, or lectured about the archaeology, looking at finding drains, old pathways, brick edging, all of those really interesting things that were so valuable for Port Arthur in the work that they were doing in restoring their gardens, but also on other people. I mean, tiles, garden edging tiles, how the design of those changed. And if you knew the design of that tile, you could then sort of date mm-hmm. certain parts of your garden. So very, very interesting practical things that we learnt. It was a very good conference.
And it leads me to think the kind of membership of the Garden History Society at that time. My feeling from reading it, on the whole, a younger membership than we have now. And was it a time when people were moving and taking interest in these old properties and restoring them, hence the interest in conserving yeah. and looking at the history?
Yes, I think that this education information role was very important. So there were a lot of younger garden owners, people that had bought older properties, and they wanted to know where to go to get help. And so they joined the association and became very active members of the association.
But it's quite, sorry, I just interrupt. It's just quite interesting because I look, and by 1983, TAS had 100 members, and this had grown by 1987 to 270, and by April 1988 to 300 members, which is rough, more than we have now presently. So it's indicative of exactly what you're talking about.
Yes. The education role. That one of the concerns that later on with the Garden History Society, there was an organisation called the Open Garden Scheme, and that was a means where people could go and pay a small amount and visit a garden on a specific day. When that Open Garden Scheme folded, there was great concern about in the National Management Committee that people that like to go and visit gardens would join the association, and that we must not lose our emphasis on education as well as garden visiting. So I think that the education aspect is very, very important, or was very important in those early years, and that was probably why we had such a, I suppose, a younger membership because they wanted to find out more about what to do if they had an early property or if they were interested in history or interested in plants. They wanted to learn.
I noticed in some of the early newsletters that, and certainly we don't do that now, that they would specify or have family events where children were invited, or on occasions there'd be specified children and dogs. Not welcome on occasion.
Yes.
Occasional things.
Yes.
So it made me think. Yes, they were much younger.
Yes.
Mm. So the change in the membership also has been probably less professional people, landscape gardener, landscape architects, garden designers, and more of the amateur gardeners of recent years. Surmising a little here,
I'm afraid I don't know. I just think that there's scope within the organisation for all of those criteria. I mean, that was one of the aims when the organisation was established, that we should have a mix of professional people plus amateur gardeners plus those who just love gardens. But we should not just concentrate on garden visiting. We should have an educational role and combine the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think my time on the recent committee, that concern of the same concerns that the focus needs to be back more on education. And if you ask many people who join, it's mainly because they want to visit interesting gardens, but we really need to have a stronger role in advocacy and conservation. Mm. But I want to now come back to the annual conferences, the national conferences that were held in Tasmania, the first one being in Hobart in 1982.
Yes.
And I think you had played quite a role in that conference.
Yes, we had a very small committee. We worked incredibly hard. We did everything ourselves, but it was a great success. We had some interesting speakers. We had in Mark Herberg, he talked about the botanical gardens and he took us to the botanical gardens. We looked at gardens around Ross. We looked at Summer Home, which is a very interesting early garden here in Hobart. And we went up to Warmers and Panshanger. And so we visited some very interesting gardens. We were determined that Tasmanian hospitality would be at the fore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, we just produced a very small brochure, and it was very successful. And Tasmanian conferences always
have been
successful because I think we just have that, we've got this wonderful state with these wonderful gardens, and we work hard and we produce good conferences.
The 1986 one was in Launceston.
I wasn't involved in the 1986 conference as much as the two Hobart ones.
Yes.
The next one was the from
1993 one in Hobart.
Yes, that was a wonderful conference. It was bigger, of course. I think we had between 150 and 200 delegates for that conference. And we had a person called Ethne Clark, who was an American garden writer who had been living in England for about 20 years and had written a number of books on cottage gardens and herb gardens. She had done some work with Rosemary Vary on a couple of her publications. And she wrote to the Australian Garden History Society and said, "I'm thinking of coming to Australia." And at that stage, the Tasmanian conference was sort of in the planning stage, and we said, "Can we bring her here for our conference?" and we will focus it on cottage gardens. So we called it From Village to Vase, The Art of the Cottage Garden. Another keynote speaker was Peter Cuffley from Victoria, who had written books on cottage gardens in Australia. So the two of them were keynote speakers along with other speakers. Mm-hmm. And
so, Anne, we were talking about the 1993 conference in Hobart and the associated exhibition. Is that?
Yes, the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery organised an exhibition at the same time, which was called The Art of the Cottage Garden. And that was a wonderful exhibition, bringing a lot of the collection from the gallery of early colonial gardens and the art of for people like Louisa Ann Meredith and Mary Morton Allport. And so that was an added bonus, but a really good collaboration between the Australian Garden History Society and the Tasmania Museum and Art Gallery. So we looked at things like English villages and gardens, and then the early colony with the fences and borders, houses and their gardens, and then gardening in the wilderness. So there was it was a good exhibition. It ran, of course, after the conference and encouraged other people to visit this exhibition and get an idea of what the association was about.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And at this time in the 1990s, there are a couple of tours, important tours, including Tasmania, and there was one of the English Garden History Society, which you were involved with. Can you tell us a bit about that tour?
Yes. As I mentioned earlier, there was quite a lot of communication between the English Garden History Society and the Australian Garden History Society. And I'm not quite sure who suggested that it would be a good idea if some of the members of the English organisation came out to Australia. So I visited the Garden History Society when I was in England, and we talked through the idea of a tour of Australian gardens. The National Management Committee gave the proposal its support, and together with Jackie Comardius, who was the executive officer of the Australian Garden History Society at the time, we organised a 24-day tour of historic and contemporary gardens of Australia in October 1998. So we started in Sydney, and we went to Parramatta, Elizabeth Farm, then down to Camden, Glenmore, Southern Highlands, to Canberra, to the National Botanic Gardens, and from there down to Lanyon, and down to Victoria, through Victoria and across to Tasmania. We had a very interesting group of people, and by the end of the tour, of course, we were very good friends. But they were just amazed at the variety of gardens and the expanse of countryside that they had to follow. Mm. One of the amusing things was we were driving down the Midlands, and one of them said, "Is that opium?" And they had never seen opium poppies growing, and they were just amazed that we in Tasmania were growing opium. But it was a great success.
Mm-hmm. Was that seen as apart from having a garden, a fundraiser for the National Management?
Yes.
And we haven't spoken much about your time on the National Management Committee. What were the key issues that were you were focusing on at that time?
There were there were funding issues, as of course course there are with every organisation. There was some changes with the way the journal was being produced, so that was one of the concerns of the organisation. And some of the branches were struggling, others were booming. It was just a matter of how we rationalised and how we grew as an organisation. My time on the National Management Committee was when Margaret Darling was chairman, and she was the most wonderful, generous, and encouraging chairman. So I really enjoyed working with her and others on the National Committee at that time.
Mm-hmm. They were based at the Conservatory, the Observatory area, yeah, in the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne,
yes,
was that
correct? Yes, that's right, yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Mm-hmm. And had a part-time...
Jackie Kamadius was the Executive Director, and again a wonderful person who organised the association. So, I mean, when you think about it, the association had started and the office was in Bowral, and then but that was a sort of an arrangement. We then established, I suppose, as any organisation has to, we established sort of as a professional organisation with an executive officer and an office.
Mm-hmm. And so... it goes on today.
Yes,
42 years later. Yes. So we're going up to about the year of 2000, which is when your active involvement in the committee finished. Are there any other observations you'd like to make about the TAS branch or garden history overall, the society?
My feeling is that perhaps we need to return a little more to the seminars and workshops and things. We had a number of those. We would try and have them on various topics in various locations, and the winter lecture series that the Tasmanian branch runs is a very worthwhile series of lectures. And we do get a large number of people at those, which I think shows that that is something that is needed within the organisation. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's something that we should look at, weekend seminars, not just a weekend when we go garden visiting, but combining the educational or the lecturing role at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, I think, my comment.
Mm-hmm. Because conservation of both landscapes and gardens and garden history is more important than ever.
Yes, definitely, mm-hmm. yes.
I think on this note, we might conclude, unless there are any other points you'd like to make, Anne. Well, again, we'd really like to say thank you for your contribution to Garden History Society, but to the Oral History Collection. So thank you.
Thank you, Jane.